Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Michael Flora, and I represent the appellant David Peasley. I'll be arguing the appeal of the dismissal of Count 6, and then my colleague and associate, Evie Scholler, will be arguing the appeal on Count 9. Dismissal of Count 6 for failure to exhaust was error, really for one overriding reason. To this day, appellees have been unable to provide a clear, plausible, coherent explanation for how David was supposed to administratively exhaust his grievance that he was being denied treatment for his type 1 diabetes. If appellees can't explain this even now clearly, how was David supposed to, at the time, divine this exhaustion procedure? In reality, he couldn't, and he had no administrative remedy that was practically available to him that he had to exhaust prior to following suit. Now, before getting more into the details of this case, I do want to address and distinguish this case from the main two cases cited in the briefs. Fuqua, which we cited, in which this court held that the administrative remedy was unavailable to the inmate there, and Kelly, in which appellees cited, in which the court affirmed a District of Nevada opinion holding that the administrative remedy was available. In both cases, the administrative remedy was clear, at least to the prison and to the court reviewing it, and the issue was, is it just too complex or nuanced for the prisoner himself to figure out? In this case, the alleged administrative remedy is even more clearly unavailable because even the prison can't explain, again, clearly, plausibly, coherently what it was. So I wondered if
what the prison meant might be about what kind of staff member was being complained about, whether it was healthcare staff or custody staff, and even that isn't entirely clear, and maybe there's no way he would have known anyway, but is that your understanding of what they meant here?
I don't have an understanding of what they meant, Your Honor, and I'm not quite sure that they did either. There were custody staff who were denying David access to medical treatment, and if the prison's position were that, well, if it's a custody staff member, it should have been you should have gone to a custody appeal. If it's a healthcare staff member, it should go to a healthcare appeal. They should have made that clear. And again, I think they're not clear themselves because at one point they said this should be a healthcare appeal, and then on the same basic complaints, they said no, this should be a non-healthcare appeal. So I think you're probably aware of what happened, but you know, after he complained about this, he submitted his first appeal on this form 602, which is for non-healthcare issues, to the regular appeals office. The regular appeals office looked at it and said, this looks like a healthcare appeal, and they sent it to the healthcare appeals office on a form 602HC, which is the form for healthcare appeals. And now, initially, the healthcare appeals office accepted it. And there's a notation that on October 14th, they accepted it and said, yes, we're accepting it. Only 2 months later did they reject it and make this argument that appellees now make that, well, you should separate your medical from your non-medical issues, with no clear explanation as to what that meant, since everything seemed to concern medical issues. He resubmitted his complaint, he attempted to clarify, and then a month later, the healthcare office again rejected or canceled the appeal. It's a little unclear. And they said, well, this should have been submitted on a form 602 to the regular appeals office, which is exactly what he did in the first place, and they already had that form. The reality is, on its face, it remains unclear how the prison expected David to submit this appeal, and I'm not quite sure they knew. And I want to contrast this case with the Kelly case cited by the appellees. In that case, the prisoner had two clearly distinct medical issues. One, he wanted surgery to treat a hernia, and two, he wanted pill or medication for his hepatitis C. He was denied both, and he submitted a single complaint, and he was told to separate those two. And if you look at the court's opinion, the court even notes that he was instructed, here are these two separate medical issues, separate them, resubmit. He didn't, and the court held that he didn't administratively exhaust. Here, there were no such clear instructions, and again, it was unclear how David should have submitted this appeal. So with that said, I'm happy to entertain additional questions from the court or turn it over to my colleague, Evie Scholler.
Thank you. And we can give you the time for rebuttal at the end if that would be helpful.
I'll reserve time just in case. 25 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Avi Schuler. I'm an associate at DLA Piper, and I represent Mr. David Peasley, as you know, on the count six dismissal, which alleged a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. The question before the court on this issue is whether the district court properly drew all inferences in favor of Mr. Peasley and assessed all the evidence he presented in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, including circumstantial evidence, to find that there was no genuine issue of material fact as to Officer Lopez's awareness of David's medical need to eat a meal at that time that she refused it.
So could I ask you, is that necessarily the way to frame the question? So it seems like we have to figure out whether she was indifferent to a medical need, but if she knew he had crackers, why should we assume that it wasn't reasonable for her to think that he wasn't in a medical emergency because he could eat the crackers?
Yes, well, the crackers are not sufficient to alleviate the medical distress of a diabetic patient at the time, which is why he repeatedly said, as the record shows, that he needs food.
But I don't think he said, I have diabetes and I have a blood sugar crisis. He said, I need food, but she said, you have crackers. I mean, she may have been wrong and he may have had a crisis, but how can we assume she knew that?
Yes, Your Honor, if you look at, actually, in the record, there is an excerpt from her deposition transcript. And in that deposition transcript, she says that she knew that the crackers were something special to diabetics and that only diabetic inmates received crackers because there was a knowledge that type 1 diabetic inmates must regulate their blood sugar levels at all times. And that is either in response to insulin shots in particular, or in general, there's a copious...
Where do we see this in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, I have that. If you look at ER 55.
She said that she knew that if a person had some crackers in her pocket, it meant that they're a diabetic on insulin, and they have to be carefully treated.
Your Honor,
the
question to to Officer Lopez in the deposition was, so crackers are something special to diabetics? And her answer is yes.
That could mean quite a few things. It could mean he likes crackers. You implied that it meant that she should know that he's a diabetic and that it has to be treated carefully. Is that just supposition, or is there something more in the record at EM 55?
There's more circumstantial evidence, Your Honor, of her subjective awareness of his acute diabetic condition, and
that is, for example, at ER 55 or someplace
Your Honor,
else.
It's at 52-54. Where they are, this is evidence that was relevant to, in fact, count six, which is an event that occurred. These are events that occurred just 1 week before with Officer Lopez. And if you look on on ER 52, it references that Officer Lopez and David engaged in a debate about his diabetic needs. ER 53, David said she knew the needs. At ER 54, Lopez was well aware of the diabetes. And further, there's also additional evidence in the record at ER 48-51, where one of David's associates, a friend in the prison, testified at length that in 2012, so a year before, there was a pattern of behavior between Officer Lopez and David Peasley where there were several incidents where she would deny his diabetic needs, including refusing to let him eat. So
I missed that in your brief. I'm sorry. Could you just refer me also to the pages of your brief so I can read that or reread it?
Yes,
you did indicate that.
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. I will find those pages.
You can bring it back later at your rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let's give you each a minute for rebuttal, but so let's go to the other side now and we'll come back for rebuttal and maybe you can find those pages.
Excuse me, good afternoon. May it please the court, Michael Quinn, counsel for defendants and appellees. In this case, the district court's decision should be affirmed for several reasons. First, contrary to what counsel indicated earlier, Peasley failed to exhaust his administrative remedies against the defendants in this case in connection with count six as required by the PLRA. In addition, plaintiff's assertion in connection with count nine that he needed lunch was not enough to raise a genuine disputed material fact as to whether Officer Lopez was aware of a serious medical need. And relatedly, with regard to count nine as well, even if his constitutional rights had been infringed in this case with regard to that interaction about lunch, defendant Lopez is entitled to qualified immunity. With regard to the exhaustion issue, counsel,
you're going to come back. I take it you're going to come back in a minute and answer your colleague on the situation of Lopez and what she knew. I take it you're going to cover that.
Correct. Lopez knew that he was a diabetic, but on that particular, with regard to that interaction regarding lunch, Peasley did not indicate that he was in any medical distress. He did not indicate that he had just had insulin. All he said was that he needed lunch. And the district court correctly determined that just on that statement alone does not create a tribal issue on the question of whether Lopez was aware of a serious medical need. If you look at the relevant case law, the cases like Lolly and Clement, where Eighth Amendment claims have been allowed to go forward against a custody staff individual like Lopez, the inmates in those cases had some kind of physical manifestation of medical distress or of some sort. Or they said, as in Lolly, my God, I'm a diabetic, I need food.
She knew he was a diabetic and he said he needed food. So why isn't it an inference that it would be equivalent to that statement?
Well, because in those cases, with regard to a diabetic, as in Lolly, he mentioned insulin there was some physical feature of an ashen look, a deteriorating physical condition. There was none of that in this case. There was Peasley stating he needed lunch. Lopez says you have an emergency snack, correct? And that was the end of it. There's just simply no knowledge, no mention of anything medical related or any of his... He doesn't indicate anything regarding his medical condition that would put Lopez on notice that, okay, this inmate has just taken insulin and needs food. This inmate appears to be faint or is exhibiting some sort of physical distress.
Is this a finding of fact or is it a conclusion of law in your view?
We have different
review procedures for law and for facts. We defer with factual issues. In your view, is this a factual issue or is it a legal issue?
Correct. I believe the district court found that there was no tribal issue of fact. There was no factual dispute regarding whether this would create an issue regarding whether there was a medical need on the part of Peasley. I mean, Peasley, both sides agree that Peasley hasn't put forward any evidence that he stated anything regarding taking insulin or anything beyond, I need lunch. He didn't say anything about his medical condition. So there's
had a history, though. We know that there's in the record, at least from a week before. I'm not quite sure about a year before, but the week before, they had this whole interaction with fighting about his diabetes. There's no question she knew he had diabetes. Right. So why isn't it just a usual assumption that if a diabetic is saying they need a meal, that it could become a medical crisis?
I don't think there's nothing in the case law that would put a charge a custody officer, a non-medical personnel with just knowledge that someone is diabetic, that they're in some sort of constant medical need for food. I mean, it's just, maybe if Lopez were a doctor, or as I said, maybe if Peasley had stated something about his condition, anything, something similar to what the individual said in Lolly. I need food. I'm a diabetic. I just took insulin and had some sort of physical observable distress. There was none of that in this case.
Could I ask you about the first issue about the exhaustion? So if an inmate had scheduled surgery, critical surgery, and an officer who's custody officer doesn't like that inmate and wants them to stay in distress and locks them in their cell so they can't go to the surgery, who do they complain to about this incident?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that sounds like an Eighth Amendment violation. But
who do you go to? Do you go to inmate appeals or do you go to healthcare appeals?
In your scenario, the officer has locked up the inmate in his cell. I think that's you would file a 602 staff complaint against the custody officer.
So is the issue that it depend where you file the complaint depends on what type of officer you're complaining about? Is that was what I was trying to figure out. It seems like that might be the case from the record. Is that your understanding? Is if you're complaining against a nurse, you have to go to healthcare appeals, but if you're complaining against a custody officer, you go to inmate appeals?
I believe so. I mean, if you're complaining about a nurse, presumably you're complaining about some sort of medical issue.
But what if the nurse hits you? Who would you complain to?
I think that would still be a healthcare issue, given that the nurse is a healthcare officer or a healthcare.
What if the nurse calls you racist names? Who do you complain to?
Yeah, I mean the 602, the staff member, the 602 staff complaint may be broad enough to cover a nurse who calls you, uses racial epithets.
Okay, so you don't sound very confident, and we looked at this record. I could not figure out where he was supposed to complain. How is a prisoner supposed to understand where to complain?
Well, it was clear that there was communication from CDCR throughout his filings, and at the very end, if you start from the back end, on January 29th of 2014, they advise him as to what color form, what form to use. And that was in reaction. The Peasley's counsel ignores his filing, his submission in mid-January 2014, supplemental excerpt of record 21, where after all the filings from Peasley in October of 14, where the prison staff kicked it to healthcare immediately because it was that 602, which is typically used for staff complaints, custody complaints. He had the term medical used 10 or 15 times. So that it was immediately sent to healthcare for review and processing. Healthcare reviews it. They get back to him in December and they say, this actually involves multiple issues. It runs afoul of the California.
But it didn't Department. Involve multiple issues. It was all about healthcare issues.
Yeah. Actually, if you look at the complaint itself, the staff, the appeal that he filed, he mentions medical issues. He mentions the term medical, but he also mentions a number of correctional officers. And there's a
yes,
number
but
of-
this gets to the staff point. If he was supposed to be directing the appeal, depending on what category of staff it was, they should have said that. But it's not. Where did they say direct the appeal to the right place, depending on what type of staff member it is?
They informed him in that December 30th letter. And it's
can
it's
you point to it for me? Where in the
sure,
which page?
It's the supplemental excerpt of record. 22, December 30, 2013. They get back to him. They cite the code of regulations that this appeal involves multiple issues that do not derive from a single event. Your appeal contains custody and medical issues that cannot be addressed together. Separate your issues and resubmit healthcare issues. This is
and where does that say it depends on the category of staff member?
Well, they didn't specify the staff member. They specified on based on the issues.
But you're saying it depends on the type of staff member.
Well, in your hypothetical, you mentioned a claim against a nurse and or a claim against a typical claim against a nurse would typically involve some sort of medical issue.
But now, his issue was a medical issue against a custody staff, so maybe it's impossible to file that.
Your Honor, if you look at supplemental excerpt record 21. He clarifies this. He received that letter on December 30th. He signed this other submission on a week later, January 8th, 2014, where he says it is not a medical issue. He quotes that code of regulations section that was in on SER 22, the December submission from the prison staff. And he says, you are in error. Multiple officers have denied access to medical care. Thus, it is not a medical issue. It is clearly a security issue involving movement of an inmate. Only then does he clarify what his claim is about. And less than a week later, the staff comes back and advises him what form to use and how, what even down to what color to use. There was no confusion. There was no confusion on the part of the staff. This was Peasley filing multiple unrelated claims, and only 3 months later.
How do you explain what? How was he supposed to divide it? What do you think he was supposed to do to divide this claim?
Well, in reality, there was nothing to divide. He clarifies it on that page 21. And I don't think you can ask his counsel about it. I don't think they're aware of this document, because this clearly indicates he's not asserting a medical issue. He's asserting something related to security, to the custody.
Well, or he's trying to comply with this crazy language of division. That's if it's called a medical issue, if it's about medical staff, and it's called a custody issue, if it's about custody staff. So he says, my problem is access to medical care. You're telling me that makes it not a medical issue because it's custody staff. So, okay, I'm talking about movement of an inmate, but when he sends it back there, they say it needs to be a medical, which is where this whole thing keeps going in a circle.
No, in the end, the final communication from the CDCR was very clear. On December 29th, this is supplemental of excerpt record number 5, I believe, sorry, where they advise him, if you would like to proceed, they receive his submission from on page 21 that about how it's not a medical issue. Less than a week later, they react to that, and they say, if you would like to proceed with a staff complaint, as he's indicated in that previous statement that he submitted, submit a green inmate parolee appeal form. And he never did. And that's the problem. If he had submitted another, they clearly indicated, if you have a staff complaint, which you apparently do, based on that SER 21, the document there, here's how you proceed. And he never did. And that runs afoul of the Ross case, where you have the inmate has to err on the side of exhaustion. They clarified what he was supposed to do, and he didn't do it.
Okay, you're over your time, so I think I need to cut you off unless my colleagues have questions.
I have another question. There was something that I read that there's a counselor in staff that helps people decide which door they're going through. Is that
in terms of the door they're going through?
Some person who is assigned in staff to be a counselor to the prisoners,
right,
when they're, what is the duty of that individual?
Of a counselor? Well, I mean, each inmate, I believe, has a counselor, and they're there for the inmates to field questions there's no briefing on that issue, but I believe that the inmate can always interact with his counselor and if the inmate has issues or questions.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That clarifies it.
Okay, so you each have a minute for rebuttal. Mr. Fleur, do you want to go first?
Yes, Your Honor, I can go quickly. The first thing I would note is that Mr. Peasley has expressed throughout the entire process the same complaints about medical issues, being denied medical treatment. I'm not sure we heard a clear explanation of how he was supposed to submit these appeals. We heard he was supposed to separate out different grievances. Then we heard he was supposed to submit a single Form 602, which is what he did in the first place. Any explanation we heard isn't found in the record. Even if it were, it wasn't explained clearly to him. He was told submit these issues separately. He was also told this appeal is accepted, and he was told it's rejected, go file the 602. And again, all of those responses were inconsistent. It's understandable that when he submitted that final additional paper on SER 21 mentioning medical issues again, he's confused. So at the end of the day, there's been no clear explanation about how he was supposed to do this. He certainly didn't know.
Thank you. Let's go to your co-counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, in response to Judge Wallace's question, the opening brief cites to those excerpts of record at page 18, and it is also referenced in pages 9 through 11 of the reply. I wanted to quickly also respond that there was a suggestion that there's nothing in the case law that supports the fact that there was enough circumstantial evidence essentially to make an inference in Mr. Peasley's favor that there was a violation. And I wanted to read just in the Farmer's case, for Farmer v. Brennan, in the Supreme Court case at page 848, where the Supreme Court discusses the fact that the summary judgment was granted, and that what the holding was that the petitioner never expressed any concern for his safety to any of the respondents. And that was the only evidence that the district court there cited for that conclusion, that there was no genuine dispute, that the respondents had no knowledge. And the court said that that wasn't correct, that there should have been a more appropriate assessment of all of the evidence, and that advance notification is not a necessary element. And that is also true in Lawley, in this court's decision in Lawley. If you look in page pin site 421, deliberate indifference may be shown by circumstantial evidence, and that in that case at 420, there's no direct evidence that any of these named defendants knew of the risk of harm. So this is the issue here, and the question there was also raised to Mr. Quinn was about whether this is factual or legal question, and what the issue is, that this is the question is whether the district court appropriately determined that there was no genuine issue of material fact, and that should be reviewed de novo.
Which is a legal question, right?
Right, exactly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're over everyone's time. Thank you all for the very helpful arguments, and thank you for participating in our pro bono program. It's very helpful to our court when counsel do that, and we really appreciate your service to the court in this regard. This case is submitted. Thank you all.
Thank you.
The next case.